It's time for Wealth DNA with Ron the Ronald Naraki. It's time to check your Wealth DNA so you can enjoy the second half of life. Here's the host of the show, Ron Naraki.
Hello, welcome to the Wealth DNA radio show, and I'm honored that you're joining us today. The last two shows we focused on investing in real estate, and today we'll continue that series. Over the next few months, we'll cover all four ways that you can invest in real estate. And as I mentioned in the past, most people choose the fifth way, and the fifth way is to do nothing. I don't recommend it, but many people do it. Today, we'll continue where we left off on April 9th, talking about investing in rental properties. Now, even before that, you may recall our guest on March 26th, Michael Fitzgerald, talked about a direct investment in real estate being one of two ways to generate cash flow that allows you to replace the income from your job. As he appropriately reminded us, financial independence or comfortable retirement is not dependent on the stash of money and assets that you accumulate, but on the amount of cash flow coming from your investments. Very true. This was such an important point, I'd like to reiterate it with a simple example. Let's say you're earning $10,000 a month from your job, and your job is working for money, and you're living comfortable at that level. So I've got to assume that you're managing on that level of income. Now, when you reach the point that your investments, and this is the money working for you, are generating $10,000 per month, then you've reached financial independence. Since you can quit your job and continue to live comfortably whenever you want. The two ways he suggested for doing this is either owning a business or direct investment in real estate. I guess he should have added, you could do both. As you know from your own experience and from the Wealth DNA radio show, both of these, owning a business and direct investment in real estate, provide the capability to shelter some of your income from taxes. So you might actually end up with a lower tax bill. By the way, if you ask your broker or financial advisor about investing in real estate, it's very likely she or he will tell you that investing directly in real estate is not a good idea. They will probably suggest you invest in REITs, real estate investment trusts, instead. After they explain how much real estate has devalued over the last 5 years, which we covered, and also that it's not regulated by the SEC, as if that helps your investment returns, you might want to ask if part of the reason they don't earn is that they don't earn a commission or a fee if you invest some of your money directly in real estate. In my experience, it's hard for someone to give unbiased advice when their income or commission is affected. Today is Monday, May 14th, 2012. It is 8:03 in Phoenix, Arizona. You're listening to the Wealth DNA radio show. I'm your host, Ron Naraki. This show airs every second and fourth Monday at 8 a.m. in Arizona. I certainly hope you can join us each time we air, but if you miss a show, you can hear it on the archives. Just go to www.wealthdna.us, where we list each of the shows, both upcoming and archived. That said, why would you miss a show? I can't think of many good reasons. Now, we've got a lot to cover, but boy, we've got some great information for you, and you will walk out of here with your PhD in rental real estate. If you listened to our last show with Michael Orr, you now know that housing prices in the Phoenix market and other parts of the country and world have been heading up, and in Phoenix, heading up for 8 months. And he estimates they will continue to increase by 2 to 5% per month for another 6 months or longer. Now, is it possible to make money if your investment appreciates only 2% per month? For simplicity, let's call that 24% per year. Now, if you borrowed 80% of the money to buy that real estate asset, which is possible, then the appreciation on your cash investment is about 120% per year. Gee, I think that's a pretty good return. So if that appreciation rises to 5%, the upper end on his forecast, 5% per month or 60% per year, then taking a mortgage for 80% of the purchase price means your cash investment would rise 300%. Now, admittedly, 300% per year sounds too good to be true. So let's assume Michael Orr and I are too optimistic and we only see that 2% per month. Would this be enough to entice you to invest in residential real estate? If not, then let me remind you one important fact, that when you invest in rentals, and while you wait for the appreciation, you also have monthly income from the rents, plus a depreciation deduction, which costs you nothing, but reduces your income taxes. Interesting. Appreciation, income, and tax deductions. Okay, for those investing in the U.S. equity markets, as I do with about half of my portfolio, you probably realize we've had a pretty bumpy ride. And after all is said and done, the S&P is back to the S&P 500 is back to where it was 2 months ago. So the last 2 months were like a roller coaster. So it sure helps if you enjoy the ride, since we ended up back to where we started. Unless, of course, you follow the long-short strategy I suggested last fall, or a bull-bear strategy if you're using your IRA funds. Then you probably took profits as the market went up, and then took some more profits as the market went down, like it is today. We'll talk about that in just a second before we move into the rental real estate. If you don't know how to use a long-short strategy or a bull-bear strategy, guess where you'll find it. I'm sure you figured it out. It's on our archives. Just look for the show on ETFs, exchange-traded funds. I'll just take a second to talk about the equity markets. If you look at the equity markets in the U.S., they're down about 1% per day. 1% today, and then 1% per day would be out of the market and basically close to zero by year end at that pace. I'm sure it won't continue. Now, Asia was also mostly lower. I think Japan was the only one that was up a little. Europe is down 2.5%, as is Brazil. That is a big drop. And remember, I'm not allowed to tell you how the financial markets or even the real estate market will perform in a specific time period. It's against the rules. But I am allowed to use that information to select the topics that we cover on this show. So that's why today we're talking about investing in rental properties. I knew that equity markets would be lousy and housing would be improving. Okay, in our April 9th show, I shared with you a lot of background on the U.S. real estate market over the last 10 years, kind of set the economic tapestry to get into this topic, some important, really important information about the relationship of real estate and inflation. If you missed that, of course, you're going to want to re-listen to that. If you're concerned about the effect of inflation on your portfolio, as I am, and your standard of living, then I suggest you re-listen to that portion of the show. We also covered the first 8 of the 30 topics you need to master, or at least be adept at, to be a successful landlord. On this show, we'll cover the remaining aspects to help you decide whether investing in rental properties is right for you. Note, although I really try to make sure we cover the fundamentals of investing, which we do here, there are times when my own business biases can affect the comments or the content. And that's why I make this warning. Now, although I invest in residential real estate, and several of the properties we own are rented, rental properties is not my preferred strategy. So hopefully it doesn't come across as if I don't like it. I just don't choose that strategy. Now, but by being aware of that, you, the listener, might help detect if there are some biases in my comments and take them with a grain of salt. I do try to be as objective as I can, giving you the facts, not opinion. So regardless of the strategy I choose for the real estate fund, knowing about and understand each of the 4 would be beneficial before you make your final decision. Now, if you decide to invest in rental properties, there are a number of topics, and that's what we started to talk about in that last show, that you need to be not only aware of, but more importantly, be prepared to deal with. There are approximately 30 of these topics. We covered 8 in the first part, and let me just review them. you'll want to go back and listen if you did miss that show. First is having sufficient cash reserves. Second was picking a property. That's a valuation. Is this property a good one to buy? Third is estimating the renovation costs. Fourth was obtaining financing. Fifth, buying the property, getting around to actually buying it after you've done those first steps. Number six is getting the proper insurance. Seven is renovating the property. And eight, which may not happen in the sequence of the time you bought it, but it may come up later, dealing with mold and dealing with it cost effectively. Okay, so let's move on to number nine on the list. Get a business license in the city or town where the property is located, not where you're located, where the property is located. This is probably the most common mistake made by landlords. They don't know the rules for business licensing on rental properties until they've done it for a while or somebody, like this show, tells them. See, each town and city has different rules, but most require you to have a business license if you own just one rental property in that city or town. It's not the cost that stops investors, but I will tell you the fines and penalties for not being licensed can add up pretty quickly and reduce your returns on rental investment. Number 10, register the property as a rental property. Now, I'm not actually sure if this one or number 9 are the most common error. In many towns and cities, the property taxes are lower if it's an owner-occupied property. So it might be tempting, and I'm not encouraging you, it might be tempting to not register it as a rental and treat it as an owner-occupied. But let me remind you, the local laws tell you whether it is required or not, and calling it owner-occupied when it really is a rental property is officially tax avoidance. You know, the illegal kind. Let's move to a number 11. Set up a separate trust and or LLC for each property. 99% of the casual rental property owners that I meet have the property purchased and the title maintained in their personal name. It's only one or two properties. What's the difference? Boy, we're going to cover a lot of those aspects today. This is really the key point you want to walk away from the show. So, put it in a trust and or LLC, and a trust does not give you the same level of protection as an LLC. Now, what happens if there's a tenant lawsuit? Now, granted, they don't happen that often, but I would say they happen a little bit more often than a fire at a property. I recall last year, my office and part of my home burned. So maybe I'm overly sensitive to this. Or what if a murder happens on the property? You know, drive-by shooting. Somebody just walks up and decides that they don't like the residence. Or there's a party at the property and somebody falls out of an upstairs window. Or let's take the ladder up against the property. You know, your roofer that you hired put a ladder up there, left it out overnight, and somebody comes in and rapes your tenant. Sounds pretty gruesome. Not only are you likely to lose that property, but if it's in your personal name, as I suggested, many people leave it, be prepared for losing your own home, all other properties you own, and potentially your entire portfolio. Now, I think I mentioned earlier that owning a property free and clear still has risks. Because a lot of people think if I don't finance it, I don't have any risks. When you lose the property, let's say because of a tenant lawsuit, and that is one of the occurrence I'm most worried about, 100% of the purchase price, 100% of the fix-up, as well as 100% of the income and appreciation you counted on for the future go with the property. Now, incidentally, setting up an LLC is pretty easy, so do it. And in states like Arizona, it's a one-time cost of less than $100. Don't let that stop you from losing everything. Alternatively, you can hire a CPA or a paralegal, or there are some companies that specialize in setting up LLCs. They'll do it from about $350 to $500 based on my research. So if you haven't done it before, or you're worried about the procedure, don't have the time, hire somebody to do it. Don't take that risk. All right, I've harped on that enough? Well, maybe. Let's move on to number 12, and you'll see that these all tie together. Get a federal employee identification number, FEIN, federal employee identification number for your LLC. And yes, if you're wondering, even though you don't have employees and you're not going to be employed by that LLC, you do need a federal employee identification number. It's basically your tax ID for that LLC. Just having the LLC and putting the property into it is not sufficient. That LLC has to be set up and run as a separate legal and separate tax entity. To do that, it needs its own FEIN. This doesn't mean necessarily you need to file a separate tax return, but actually I'm getting ahead of myself. We'll come to that in just a few moments. So you get a federal employee identification number. Now, for the last few topics, registering a property, getting a business license, etc., setting up the LLC, if you happen to be investing in the Phoenix real estate area, I can send you the links to help you get started on each of these topics much faster. Getting the FEIN is through the IRS, and of course that applies to everybody investing in rental properties in the U.S., so it's the same link, but again, I can send that to you, not a problem, but it's pretty easy to find and easy to do. It may take you 5 minutes. Number 13, open a separate bank account for the LLC. So you've set up the LLC, you have a separate FEIN, and you think you're done, right? No. Those steps are necessary, but not sufficient. You need a separate bank account, and very importantly, you need to make sure that the rents flow into that account and expenses for the property flow out of that account. When it comes time for a lawsuit, lawyers know that landlords frequently happen to pay a few small bills individually or collect some of the money directly in their name, and that's generally enough for the LLC to be treated as just another one of your personal pockets. Now, once the lawyer gets into one pocket, they will continue to your other pockets. So number 13, open a separate bank account for the LLC. Yes, I know, banks charge for maintaining an account, and there are some ways around that, but it is expensive, or relatively, it seems. But again, you've worked hard for the assets you're accumulating. Number 14, transfer the property into the trust and or LLC. Wait a minute, I thought that was done. Well, probably not. See, most people buy the property as an individual, especially if they're going to finance it. The bank requires it. Uh-oh, we're not getting audio online. I just got that message. I'm wondering if, Pete, are you aware of that? We are not getting the audio online, and I don't know why. Let me just see if I can hear it. I'm hearing it. I have it by phone. Okay. For some reason, check, John, sorry, just a quick distraction here in the chat message. I see that one of the people is, okay, is not getting the audio, but it is working. There might be, your speaker might be on mute on the little radio player. But okay, thank you for the chat message. See, we do pay attention to the chat messages. Now, because you bought the property, most likely bought the property in your own name and financed it, that means it's in your own name. So even though you have this LLC in its own bank account and its own FEIN, you're still not protected. The LLC has to own the property. And therefore, you need to transfer the property deed into that LLC. Now, every title company will gladly handle that for you. But here's a hint. You can do it for yourself for about 5% of the cost. Yeah, 5% of the cost, not 5% less. But Ron, you ask, I have a mortgage on the property, and it has a due on sale clause. Could the bank come after me for the property if I move it into an LLC? Because it says something about transfer and sale. That question is a bit beyond the scope of what we can possibly cover in 1 hour today. But let me give you the brief answer. They could, but it's highly unlikely. And very unlikely they actually end up with a property if it goes to court. For your information, I always send an estoppels letter. That's estoppels, E-S-T-O-P-P-E-L-S, estoppels letter to the mortgage lender. So they are informed that the property is in an LLC intentionally. Now, when you move to a trust, they can't even say no. There's a hint, and that's why I mentioned trust and or LLC, and I prefer the and. So there's a lot of little nuances as you move into your PhD in rental properties, things that you can improve on the processes to avoid these risks. All right, let me remind you, you're tuned into the Wealth DNA radio show. I'm your host, Ron Naraki, and I look forward to you joining us every second and fourth Monday. If you've missed some of the prior shows, like the first two in this series, or if you want to re-listen to them, we maintain an archive of shows just for you on www.wealthdna.us. Now, if you'd like to get an email reminder of the shows that are coming up, you can do one of two things, or do both. Just send an email to me, ron@wealthdna.us. Simple, huh? Just like the name of the radio show. We'll keep you posted about future shows and events, or in the upper left side of the screen, way up at the very top, just under the Boomer and the Babes picture, click the follow button. You'll be informed of each of the great shows in the Boomer and the Babe network. And trust me, I do that. I don't get any spam. If you're expecting me to give you a yes or no answer as to whether you should be investing rental properties, you will be disappointed. Yeah, I'm not going to give you that direct advice. If, on the other hand, you're looking for more information on why it might or might not make sense, and what factors influence whether it's right or not right for you, then keep listening. That's what we're covering today. And we're covering in pretty good detail. Okay, we've covered 14 of the topics a landlord should be adept at. Let's move on to number 15. Inform the IRS how the LLC would be taxed. Now, wait a minute. You mean I have to contact the IRS and let them know I formed an LLC and how I want to have it taxed? After all, I already got an FEIN from them. Isn't that enough? Actually, this one's pretty easy. Don't stress on this one. If you're the only owner of the LLC, or you and your spouse are the only owners, the default is that the LLC is disregarded for tax purposes. It's still a separate entity, but all of the taxes flow through to your personal tax return, so you actually don't need to file anything. So if that's what you want, then just leave it alone. If that's not what you want, you don't want it to flow to your tax return, you want it to be taxed separately or have additional partners, then you need to file the appropriate form with the IRS to let them know which option you've chosen. And there are several. You can be a C-Corp from a taxation viewpoint, S-Corp, or partnership. Now, just to let you know how my fund is structured, because we've gone a couple steps further to isolate the individual shareholders from the properties. BI Solutions is a corporation. You'll often hear me say BI Solutions Corp. It is a corporation with an S-Corp tax structure. Okay, what does that mean? That means the corporation doesn't pay any taxes. No, it's not some sort of avoidance. That's the structure. Instead, all of the taxable gains and losses flow directly to the shareholders. So it's just like they owned the properties, but they are isolated from them. Now, additionally, and here's the point I want to emphasize, the corporation does not own a single property or a single private mortgage. The corporation instead owns separate LLCs, and they have taxes flowing direct to the corporation. Because each LLC is only owned by one shareholder called the corporation, the LLC is disregarded for tax purposes, and its taxes flow to the corporation. What's the advantage to us? First of all, we have a couple levels of protection. Secondly, we only have to file two tax returns, at least for now. Those things could change. Even though we have lots of entities, only two tax returns, one federal tax return and one state. Okay, that's the structure we've chosen. And maybe that the lawyers get so aggressive eventually that we have to do some further separation. We'll talk about that before we finish this list of 30. All right, number 16, write an operating agreement for the LLC. Wait a minute. This is getting pretty tedious, Ron. You mean to be an official standalone entity, it needs to have its own operating agreement? Yes. Many lawyers, paralegals, and companies that form those LLCs will help you. As a matter of fact, often in their fee they will develop that operating agreement for you. And that's probably the most difficult part for the person that's never done this before. For them, they copy the last one they did and charge you a few hundred. But again, it may be worth it. If you'd like, I'll give you one hint. Include every single possible business activity the LLC could ever be engaged in, not just what you envision, but what it could be engaged in. There is no benefit to you for setting it up for very specific purpose. For in other words, only does rental real estate in this state. None of us are smart enough to know what the future has in store. And as you hear the other strategies, you might decide that over time, your LLC will evolve and change in which strategy is included. Okay, let's move to number 17. Keep separate books for each LLC. I've hinted at this before with the bank account. The money has to flow through a separate bank account. But number 17 says keep separate books, actually separate accounting books for each LLC, even if tax-wise it's going to flow to your tax return. And now for sure you're saying, Ron, you sure all this LLC stuff is really needed? This is getting pretty tedious. Keep in mind, most of this stuff is a one-time setup. I know it sure seems like an awful lot of work. Just to avoid losing everything I own in the event of a lawsuit. Wait a minute. Let me reread that statement. It's to avoid losing everything I own in the event of a lawsuit. Okay, maybe it is worth it. Well, you might not have hired an accountant to solve your plumbing problem. You remember my analogy in the earlier show. But you might need one to help you run the books for the LLC. Personally, again, my hint. Most investors are overly concerned about the complexity of accounting. It's not so difficult. I think most people that own 1 to 5 properties can easily handle the books using a simple program like Quicken. And that is probably the most prevalent program for accounting. Very, very straightforward, just like balancing your checkbook. And you have separate accounts for your company. No, I am not commissioned by Intuit, the maker of and sales company for Quicken. And yes, by the way, that is the same Intuit that sells QuickBooks as well as TurboTax, which also can be very useful for your own accounting and taxes. Full disclosure, we use them all. Number 18, know the rules in the Landlord-Tenant Act. This one's so important, let me repeat it. Know the rules in the Landlord-Tenant Act. Unfortunately, each state has a slight variation, so you have to know it for the state that you're operating in. And as some people appropriately say, if you don't know your rights, you don't have any. And even though your tenant doesn't own the property, they just might if they know the law better than you do. Or they hire a good lawyer who obviously knows the law better than most of us do. As usual, you have the choice. You can get to know that law, or you can hire a lawyer at $200 an hour or more to try to fix problems you could have avoided. This is an important one. You have to know that Landlord-Tenant Act. There are other federal laws, and I'll mention probably the most common one you'll bump into is fair housing. That also apply to landlords. Now, here's my humble opinion. And again, I'm warning you, it's an opinion, not necessarily, and it's an educated opinion. It's not just there's no factual evidence to prove this one way or another. If you follow the Landlord-Tenant Act and apply some common sense, you're not likely to have problems with the other laws. Although, again, many people appropriately point out common sense is not as common as it used to be. So Landlord-Tenant Act is probably the most important one you need to get to know, but there are other federal laws that govern it, and if you're wondering about who you should exclude having as a renter, that's when you should read Fair Housing and some of the others. Let's move on to number 18. Advertise and market the rental. Wow, we're all the way up to number 19, and we still have a vacant property that's costing us a lot each month and earning nothing? So I guess you could joke that the first 18 steps of owning a rental property is kind of like having kids. Clearly, advertising and marketing can be expensive, but there's nothing like a vacant rental property to make you realize how important it is to do, and to do it well. Personally, again, my advice, I find that a sign in front of the property, listing it on Craigslist, and networking with friends and family are the most effective means for renting a property. And there are other free listing sites. Take advantage of them. Now, if those all don't work, then your local newspaper or listing on MLS, when I say local newspapers, the one local to the property, not to where you live, or a listing on MLS might make sense, MLS being the multiple listing service. Now, MLS does get the word out to thousands of realtors that your property is for rent. That's good, right? But keep in mind, their commissions on rentals are minuscule compared to property sales, so they don't spend a lot of time on them. Additionally, the majority of renters don't contact a realtor to find a rental. When you were renting a property, or maybe you do, did you contact a realtor to find one? Chances are you didn't. So anyway, MLS is an avenue. It does work, but there is some expense involved, and secondly, not everybody uses it, so it doesn't cover the whole world. What do people do if they don't contact a realtor? They look around in a 1 or 2 mile radius of where they live or work, and that's why the sign tends to work well. Also, when I talk to investors who specialize in rental properties, they remind me that dropping the price by $50 per month, the rental price, may be a lot less expensive than having it vacant for another month. So don't overprice it. Number 20, check your applicants. Okay. All of the 30 topics we're covering and have covered are equally important to the ultimate profitability of your investment. As one of my old bosses would say, this topic might be more equal than the others. More equal than the equal topics. From my experience, a bad tenant costs you about $3,000 in damage and legal fees. That's in addition to, so add these on, it's the lost rent while you get the property ready for the next tenant, and possibly some other legal fees. So anyway, what can you do to make sure you get qualified tenants? One, I mentioned early in the first show, fix up your property so it looks like a place the quality tenant wants to live in. That's the first step. The other is to screen your applicants thoroughly. Now, there are a number of services, both national and regional. I'm not going to advertise any specific one. You want to take a look at them. They cost you between $20 and $60 per applicant. And by the way, there's no reason you can't charge your applicants that fee, or at least a portion of it. I choose to charge them 50% of the cost. And by the way, be sure to screen each person over the age of 18. Even if they're not employed, they could have some history that you need to know about. What do you want to look at? Well, first of all, their rental history, their employment history, their credit report, and finally, their criminal background. Many homeowners associations, or HOAs, require you to run a criminal background check. I'm not suggesting, trust me, I'm not suggesting you discriminate based on their criminal background, but you need to know. Let's move on to 21. Sign a contract with your tenants. Ah, we finally reached the point where we're about to start earning money on this investment. But don't get so excited that you ignore some important components. Let me give you an example. I know some neighbors that rented their home to people they knew, friends. Thus, you wouldn't charge friends a security deposit, would you? Well, now they really regret it. Not only have they lost their friends, but they've also lost money getting the property fixed up when they moved out. Keep in mind there is a legal limit as to how much that security deposit can be, and it is in the Landlord-Tenant Act. And there are limits on how much can be non-refundable. Some landlords try to make the security deposit non-refundable for cleaning and painting and fix-up, whatever else. There are limits on that, so please do be aware of the limits in your state. I highly suggest having a crime-free addendum in your contract. Again, some HOAs require it. All right, now my favorite topic. Deal with the 4 T's. What are the 4 T's? Tenants, trash, toilets, and termites. Or you can, well, that's number 23. Let's cover these 4 T's before we talk about the alternative. These 4 T's are the most common complaint we hear from landlords. It's the reason more people aren't investing in rental properties, or they are, the 4 are the reason. After all, if it wasn't for tenants, being a landlord would be easy. Of course, without tenants, it wouldn't be very profitable, would it? It is necessary to make sure that your tenants take care of the trash around the property, or you do. Trash, you see, is like gophers or groundhogs. If you have a little around, it attracts more trash. And then how about the phone calls at night because the toilet's plugged, as if you, the landlord, threw the ball in the toilet or didn't post a sign over it asking women not to dispose of their tampons there. And then, of course, there are termites. Termites are a huge problem in various parts of the country, especially humid parts of the country. In Arizona, we're pretty lucky. Even though all properties either have them or will have them, fortunately, those termites only eat cellulose. That's paper, not wood. So if the ground or foundation is treated properly, you'll keep the termites away, and the damage will be minimal. I just had a termite treatment done at a property we sold this weekend, and even my own home had termites when I bought it. My home, fortunately, was less than 5 years old, and thus under the original termite treatment warranty, they had to come back and do it all over again. If I'm starting to turn you off about investing in a rental property, it's not because of my bias. Let's talk about an alternative. Number 23, especially for you that don't like to deal with the four T's, hire a property manager. Property managers can, or at least they will claim to handle, all of the time-consuming and difficult aspects of owning that rental property. Not only the four T's, but also marketing and finding tenants. Now, the only experience I've had with property managers has been a bad experience. So I am a bit biased based on my own history. I'm sure they're not all bad. I know they're not all bad. But here's tip number one. Get recommendations from other landlords in the specific area of your property, not where you live, not where others have rental properties if it's in a totally different area of the city, in the area your property is. Then check out those property managers with the Better Business Bureau. Very simple to do. If you see a lot of complaints, and whether or not they've been resolved amicably, appropriately, that gives you a yellow or red flag. And the BBB will probably rate them as well. Property managers can indeed make it possible to invest in rental properties, even if you're working a full-time job. But they don't work for free. Let's talk about their costs for just a second. The difficulty is each of them has a different fee structure. In other words, you get their agreement and you have to read it. And you then have to kind of map out how do they compare to others on all the various factors. Many charge that amount even when it's vacant. Caution. Caution. Do you want them to be charging you when the property is vacant? In other words, they haven't done their job of finding tenants. Let's say the property rents for $1,000 per month, but it's vacant. You would be paying $100 per month from zero income. Now, 10% on the surface sounds not that bad, not that high. But frankly, even if it were 25% or percentage of profit rather than of the gross rent, I'd be much more likely to use property managers. Unfortunately, their fee could be your entire profit margin. Now, profit margin is a key topic we absolutely need to talk about, and we'll cover it just after we end these 30 topics. Let's move on to 24. File your state sales tax returns. Huh? Sales tax returns? What are you talking about, Ron? Nobody told me about this. And even worse, in some states, they have really flaky names. Like in Arizona, it happens to be called TPT, which stands for Transaction Privilege Tax. Not a pleasant-sounding name when you're taxed for the privilege of doing transactions, specifically rental transactions. Some states call it just what it is, a sales tax on rental properties. So each payment you invoice your tenants creates a tax liability. It's generally 1% to 3% of the rent, so it's not real high, but it does require monthly or quarterly tax returns. In most cases, you can add this tax to your rental price. It all depends on how you put it in your rental contract. Notice I said that you incur this tax liability when you invoice the tenant. So yes, if they default or fail to pay the rent, you would pay the tax and have to ask for a refund later. Number 25, evict a deadbeat tenant. Now, if you did your screening properly, You avoided renting to somebody who had a number of evictions on their record, and you made sure that they paid their bills regularly, then hopefully you never have to evict a tenant. But unfortunately, if you're in the rental business for any length of time, it will happen, as certainly as night follows day. Now, the eviction process differs in each state and even in every county. Generally, it's handled by the Justice of the Peace. And there are only two people that can represent you in the court hearing, you as the landlord, either you or a lawyer. So you can't send a power of attorney, your friend, or an associate. You have to have a lawyer or yourself. Very few landlords handle their own evictions, probably because they think it's complicated. Now, I happen to handle most of my own. And I got to tell you, there's no better way to get to know what judges are looking for than when you hear 30 to 40 eviction cases in 1 hour. They really go fast. If the tenant doesn't appear at the hearing, which is pretty typical, the case is ruled in favor of the landlord, as long as the paperwork was handled properly. You, of course, have to handle the paperwork properly. By handling mine, I not only save a little bit in legal costs, but in several cases have been able to work with the tenant to get caught up on their payments. Sometimes it just takes an eviction, an actual judge saying you have been evicted and they have nowhere to live, for them to understand the importance of paying their rent on time. And if they now understand that, we can often get back on track. Now, for those listeners that just tuned in, you're listening to the Wealth DNA Radio Show. I'm your host, Ron Naraki. You can listen to the earlier portion on the archive, or if you missed prior shows, you can find them on the archives on wealthdna.us. Today, we're answering the question, should you invest in rental properties? And specifically, we're addressing the 30 key topics you need to be prepared to deal with. We've covered 25 of them, so we're in the home stretch. Walk-through inspection is number 26. I didn't mention this when a tenant moves in, but I'll mention it here. When they are leaving or when they're moving in, you're going to do a walk-through inspection. You're going to make a list of things that need to be fixed as they're leaving. What needs to be damaged? What has been damaged? What needs to be repaired? And what can be treated as wear and tear, or what can be treated as damage? Of course, your Landlord-Tenant Act dictates what can and can't be treated that way. A lot of it is judgment and getting the two of you to agree. Number 27, refund their security deposit. And here again, if you deduct some amount from the security deposit, you need to know that difference. What's normal wear and tear for the amount of time they've been in there versus damage to the property? And importantly, you need a good estimate for what the cost of repair is. The best is to get a written estimate from somebody. Or go ahead and get it fixed, and now you have an invoice. But caution, if a tenant knows their rights better than you do, you'll have to pay their full security deposit back, as well as small claims court costs, and then cover the repairs from your own pocket. More accurately stated, cover them from your LLC's bank account. I'm sure you caught that. Number 28, collect on a court judgment. You see, after an eviction, or if the damages on the apartment far exceed their security deposit, you would probably take your tenants to small claims court. If you know your rights, there's a pretty good chance you'll get a judgment against that tenant. But a judgment against the tenant is just another piece of paper with a judge's signature. Yes, it is recorded. It does affect their credit report. So if nothing else, the next landlord will be forewarned. But that judgment generates no cash unless you're able to collect it from the tenant. Let me tell you my personal experience. Not a single tenant after the judgment has come to me and said, here's the money I owe you. It then requires hiring a collection agency or another court filing to collect on that court judgment. Unfortunately, that court filing is fairly involved and time-consuming, so very often we don't bother filing it. But if you are successful, and in larger cases you should, it's possible to have their wages garnished or even their tax returns garnished to collect from that tenant. But please note, it may take years to collect the entire amount. Okay, we've covered 28 of the topics. You probably think there are only two left. Well, on this show, we always give you more than your money's worth. We'll cover more than 30. Number 29, cost segregation of your property cost basis. What does that mean? Cost segregation of your property cost basis. Now, unless you use an accountant specialized in real estate investing, chances are you're going to miss the benefit of cost segregation. What is it? Well, under IRS rules, you have the privilege and actually the obligation to depreciate your property over 27 and a half years. So every year, you're able to take a depreciation deduction for a portion of what you have invested in the property. If you do what most non-sophisticated investors, in other words, non-listeners to this show, would do, each year you would take a deduction for that 3-plus percent of the original cost basis. It's not exactly 3.6 if you divide 27% into one. It is because you don't depreciate the entire property value. I'll get to that. Now, this deduction lowers your taxable income, even though it's not a cash expense. You don't pay anybody the depreciation. It's a non-cash expense you deduct. When you sell the property, you will have to recapture some of that depreciation. But during the years you own the property, that depreciation basically increases your after-tax profit. Cost segregation now allows you to dramatically increase the amount of depreciation in the early years legally. How? Remember, you're going to depreciate the property value minus the land. Okay, you got to subtract off the land. But any improvements can be depreciated over their useful life. So if you bought the property and you do some renovation, that renovation is a separate asset, and it's not depreciated over 27 and a half years. It's depreciated over a shorter time period. And even when you bought the property, you invested in kitchen cabinets, appliances, floorings, blinds. Those assets you can depreciate over 5 or at most 10 years. The trick is to allocate the original purchase price properly among the various asset types. And then again, segregate your renovation costs from the property itself. You will depreciate much more quickly in those early years. Send the 1099 INTs and 1099 MISCs by January 31st every year. Unless you do everything yourself and you only use bank financing, you will have an obligation to prepare and send 1099s each January to your vendors and your lenders. They even rhyme. Seldom would an accountant include that in their standard service. Unfortunately, these are not tax forms you can download from the IRS, print them out, and file them. They are red forms with copies, just like the old carbon copy days, for vendors and lenders you pay during the year. Now, for landlords listening to this show and hearing this for the first time, you could have penalties for not filing. Unfortunately, ignorance is not a legitimate defense. Listeners of this show, who decide to invest in real estate rental properties, of course, will know what they need to do to comply with the various rules, regulations, and taxes. Being late on these forms is usually not a big deal because they go to your vendors and your lenders. And if you tell them that you're a little bit behind schedule, they usually don't mind. Most of them don't file their taxes so soon that it causes them a problem. If they are in a hurry, they'll let you know. Now, number 31, that's not the end of it. You have to now file those 1099s and 1096s by February 28th to the federal government. So in addition to sending the copy to your vendors and lenders, you have to send the first red copy to the IRS by February 28th. Yes, and even on leap year, it is February 28th, not the last day of February. You need to file that red copy, okay? So as you prepare those forms, you may have noticed that you don't know the tax ID numbers of some of your vendors, or maybe even your lenders. As the person paying them, it's your obligation, not theirs, to request a W-9 from each of them. Now, a tip I learned recently. If you use TurboTax for Business, that's a good program, there's a link to their online software that allows you to generate these 1099s for your vendors and lenders, as well as filing them electronically with the IRS. This really can save a lot of time. The data gets stored for next year, and you can do it for multiple LLCs using the same vendors. I only wish I knew years ago. It really is very, very handy. Number 32, File your annual income taxes by March or April 15th. What do you mean March? April 15th is the tax deadline, isn't it, Ron? Well, it depends on how you've chosen to have your LLC taxed. If it's to you, it would be April 15th along with your personal return, or it could be March 15th if you've chosen to file a separate corporate tax return. Our corporate tax return is due March 15th. Now, in either case, you can file for an extension, but let me give you one caution. If you have multiple shareholders, then they can't file their personal taxes until they receive the K-1 from your LLC. So they might push you to get it done on time. Number 33, protect your assets from tenants and lawyers. Now, if you've done most of the prior steps we talked about, the LLCs, the banks, all that stuff that sounded very tedious, you're reasonably well protected. Maybe you're in the 98% level, okay? Almost nothing is 100%. We can get to 100% with this step. The two things that you might want to consider to further insulate you from that personal liability, because that's really the thing. You can't necessarily protect yourself from not losing something if indeed the judge finds you at fault, but at least insulate you from the personal liability and losing your assets. There are two more things. First, you have a fairly high mortgage on your rental property. Instead of losing the entire property, you might only lose a little bit of equity, because that mortgage has to be paid off, and is paid off then by whoever took the property. The second is to have multiple shareholders on the LLC. Several states, the lawyers have gotten very aggressive. Fortunately, Arizona is not one of them. You see, the U.S. has a lot of lawyers, a lot more than any other country as far as I know, and they will find tenants to represent. And the most likely way for lawyers to earn high fees is to find landlords that are not well protected. Just like with evictions, you may never be faced with a tenant lawsuit. But if you are, it will be time-consuming and expensive. Even if all the laws are in your favor, that doesn't mean frivolous lawsuits can't go through. And if you're not well protected and there is a judgment against you, you could lose not just the property, but all the assets you've worked long and hard for. So all of these steps are necessary. Number 34, and this is the last one, folks. The advantages of having a real estate investment fund, and we just happen to be one, the iSolutions Corp is one, manage that investment property. I mentioned property managers, but there is a way to partner with an investment fund. And since there's a lot to know and a lot to handle if you do it yourself, it just may make sense to partner with somebody who, unlike a property manager, takes a percentage of profits and therefore has the incentive to earn more for you so they earn more. Okay, that's number 34. Think about that. Now, one question, so there, in addition to these points, there are a few questions that you are asking. Many of our friends and potential investors ask us. Let me run through some of those, and some of them that I promised to cover as part of this show. One question I often get asked is, should I invest in single-family homes or in multi-unit properties? They're also known as apartments. Here I have to remind you of my bias. It is based on my experience and my fund's investment strategy. I do invest in single-family homes, but I'm going to try to be fair and tell you the advantages to each of them. I think I just had an air conditioner kick on. Okay, let's take single-family homes. They are more attractive to families. Families often want a private yard for their kids and maybe for the family dog. And I will tell you, at the same price, in a similar location, most people prefer to live in a single-family home than an apartment complex. On the other hand, landlords often prefer multifamily properties, and there are two key arguments for that. You have several tenants under one roof, so you can more economically deal with repairs and even collecting rents. You only drive to one place instead of several. And number two, it is rare that you'll have all units vacant, and thus you have some cash flow almost all the time. With a single-family home, it's either 100% occupied or zero. Now, what level of profitability can you expect by investing in rental properties? Here's the key question I'm sure you were asking about. The most accurate response is, as usual, it depends. Now, that may be an accurate response, but it is, of course, totally useless. A reasonable range of profitability is 5 to 8% annual returns, plus the tax benefits or depreciation deduction, plus the appreciation of the property. So it's not bad. Your returns can be much higher, first, if you manage by yourself, and secondly, if you buy the property at a low price. Now, this second factor is what's attracted many investors and many companies to providing turnkey rentals. You bring the cash, they do the rest. There was a recent article in the New York Times, by the way, on this topic, which confirmed that even the large investment companies that are jumping into the market and buying up lots of properties, single-family properties, also target 6 to 8% returns. Now, they do have some economies of scale, but on the other hand, unlike you, they have to hire a lot of people to find properties, to manage them, deal with financing, and attract investors. So they have some overhead, too. So again, 5 to 8, reasonable return, and you can make that higher. Now, let's talk for a moment about the companies that handle turnkey investment properties. They make most of their money buying properties at a low wholesale price, fix them up at a minimal cost, and charge you, the buyer, a retail price. Now, when you realize they earn between $10,000 and $30,000 for each property they renovate and sell to you, you probably realize your returns will be a lot higher if you did it all on your own. Now, many of these companies claim that you, the buyer, will earn double-digit returns on the investment in buying that property. And they can actually support it, but they have to use very liberal assumptions, like the property is always fully rented, no vacancies, and you never have any maintenance costs. Have you ever lived in a property that didn't require maintenance? I haven't. Okay, that said, now there is a significant advantage to buying a property that's already renovated and rented, if you're financing the property. Let me emphasize that, if you're financing the property. Let's take a simple example. Okay, you want to take a pencil and paper, or you can follow this one. I try to keep the numbers simple. Say a foreclosed property can be purchased, whether you buy somebody else, for $50,000. Okay, a pretty low-cost property. If you use bank financing, you should be able to get a $40,000 mortgage, assuming banks are lending. That property might require, and this is pretty typical, about $10,000 in renovations in order to be rented out, and might be vacant for 2 to 3 months while marketing it for rent. So at this point, and I won't go through the calculations of the monthly costs, but at this point you've got somewhere around $25,000 of your own money invested, your $10,000 down, $10,000 renovations, another $5,000 in carrying costs, and you have a $40,000 mortgage. I'll do the calculation for you. That's a 61% leverage. Now, if instead you bought that property all fixed up and already rented, and you bought it for $75,000, you could now go get 80% financing and thus have a $60,000 loan. You've paid a higher price, but you've invested less cash. For those of you that say you'd rather buy it for cash and not have a mortgage, please re-listen to the Wealth DNA series on OPM, and then listen to the remaining shows in this series, especially the one on private mortgage lending. Hopefully, I'll change your mind. How can you get started in rental properties? My final question here, and I'll try to help you with. My suggestion is get involved in your local real estate investor association. They are commonly called REIAs, R-E-I-A, Real Estate Investor Association. And don't view the other members as competitors. View them as potential partners and people you can learn from. And full disclosure, I am an active member of the Arizona Real Estate Investors Association, ASREA. Typically, these associations have monthly meetings and then even subgroup meetings focused on topics like owning rental properties that just might be of interest to you. There's also a fairly new organization, I'm going to say it's about a year old now, called ARPOLA, A-R-P-O-L-A, that you should join. It stands for American Rental Property Owners and Landlords Association. It's a national organization. For around $40 per year, you have access to other landlords, and you can talk to them. Educational material, discounts with a number of national vendors like Lowe's, and by the way, my Lowe's discounts more than pay for my membership, tenant screening services, property insurance, as well as asset protection lawyers. If any of these topics sounded scary and you really want to make sure your assets are protected, there's an organization that can provide it at a much lower cost than anyone else I know. Okay, personally, I'd feel guilty if you decided to invest in real estate and rental properties or decided to not invest based on incomplete information. Unfortunately, there are millions of landlords around the world that make their decision based on incomplete information. These landlords are likely experiencing a lower return they could have, or they may have lost everything because of a tenant lawsuit. And I certainly don't want those things to happen to you. Okay, let's summarize some of the stuff we've covered, and I actually will throw in a little bit of additional material that I didn't cover as advantages in the first show. But to answer the question, should you invest in rental properties, I suggest a little more analysis before proceeding. First, if you listen to these 34 topics, how would you rate your skills on each of them? It would be helpful if you feel competent in the vast majority of these topics, or at least you feel you can learn each of them as you proceed. Secondly, consider your alternatives. Recall there are four ways to invest in real estate. We've just covered the first, investing in rental properties. Maybe your skills and the time you have available would be better suited for one of the others. How would you know? By listening to the next few shows when we talk about the details of each of these investment strategies. Now, I've mentioned that owning rental properties is not our preferred strategy. It's not, and this is the honest truth, as they would say. It's not because I feel rental properties are a bad investment. To the contrary, it's very likely rental properties purchased at today's depressed bargain basin prices will actually outperform some of the other strategies. See, our fund selected a strategy of being home providers by providing financing on homes. So our primary strategies are lease-to-own and private mortgage lending. And they also happen to be the least known of all the strategies. Now, during the first part of April, I shared with you three very powerful reasons for investing in real estate. All of them apply to all four ways, not just owning rental properties, but let me just repeat the first ones I mentioned. You are investing locally. Recall, when you invest on Wall Street, those bonuses don't get invested in your local market. They don't create jobs where you live, and they don't create demand for rental property. When you invest locally, it does. Second, and we spent a lot of time on that in that show, inflation. It's been pretty low for a very long period of time, and there's no guarantee that it will stay that way. And as I argued, just the opposite. There's a very good chance that housing will be the driver that drives the CPI up dramatically. Okay, diversification was the third one I mentioned. When you invest directly in real estate, you now have part of your portfolio in a very different investment than the Wall Street and other financial markets. Now, there are a few more advantages I want to just add. And again, most of these apply, I think all of them apply, to the various ways of investing in real estate, not just in rental properties. So this would hopefully entice you to listen to the rest of the shows. Safety and security, one of the biggies. See, unlike stocks and commodities where you own a piece of paper, and actually it's held, that piece of paper is held by your broker that documents you own something, in real estate you actually control the physical property. Fifth in that list of items is tax benefits. We talked about those some. Especially with rental properties, you get that depreciation deduction. Number six, you're in control. Not some fund manager specialist on the stock exchange that decides your financial destiny. You do. Number seven, there are very few barriers to entry. This is one that just kind of came to me a few days ago. See, unlike being a doctor, you don't require years of education and a residency to start investing in real estate. Unlike starting a bank, you don't have to file for licenses for several years and have hundreds of thousands of dollars of capital. And even unlike becoming a realtor or mortgage broker or stockbroker, you don't require special licensing. So really, there are very few reasons you can't be a real estate investor. Number eight, and maybe one that would entice you the most, residual income. especially with rental properties. The rent continues to come in while you sleep, while you vacation or retire. Now, I'm not saying, and you can tell from the list of 30, there's no work. I'm not saying that there's no work required. It does require you, basically to be there all the time. It doesn't require you to be there all the time. You can collect the rent even though you're on vacation. Now, as I suggested, one of the best ways to make the right decision related to whether you should or shouldn't invest in real estate, specifically in rentals, is to, and by the way, it's also the same way to increase your portfolio return and to lower your risk, is to tune into the show every 2 weeks. But those are the topics we cover. We'll challenge you, share great ideas, inspire you to be as wealthy as you want to be. Let me remind you, the next Wealth DNA radio show is the fourth Monday of May. That's Monday, May 28th at 8 a.m. in Arizona. Same place, same time. We'll be talking about the second most common real estate investment strategy. That's buying, renovating, and selling properties. This is often referred to as the fix and flip strategy. The archives of past shows, and of course this one, are available on wealthdna.us. Now, if you have some suggestions about topics or guests, or if you have some questions, or you haven't received emails reminding you about this show, send an email to me, ron@wealthdna.us. We'll keep you posted about future shows and events. And FYI, the next Boomer and Babe show is at 12 noon today. Go global fast. And if you're not already doing it, consider a direct investment in real estate, and maybe rental properties are perfect for you. Happy investing.
You've been listening to Wealth DNA with the Ron Naraki. Wealth DNA is a Boomer and the Babe Enterprises radio production. Contact them at boomerandthebabe.com.